Mandatory opening narration. Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome. Today, we're taking a deep dive, really getting under the skin of a monumental work. Mario Vargas Llosa's 2000 novel, The Feast of the Goat, or La Fiesta del Chivo.
It really is monumental. And maybe more than just a political novel, it feels almost like a necessary literary autopsy. Vargas Llosa, you know, the Peruvian Nobel laureate.
Yeah.
He's a giant of the Latin American boom.
Right.
But his style, it often diverges from, say, the magical realism we associate with others from that period. He's deeply invested in what some critics call the cartography of structures of power.
That's a really important point. He has this relentless focus on historical reality, the mechanics of political control,
yeah.
And the Feast of the Goat. It's arguably the definitive modern dictator novel.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the dictator in question is Generalissimo Rafael Leonidas Trujillo. Governed the Dominican Republic for 31 terrifying years, known as El Chivo, the Goat.
Chilling nickname.
It is. And while his rule was long, the novel zeroes in, very intensely, on the final months. Really, the days leading up to his assassination on May 30th, 1961. It's like watching the last gasp of a totalitarian system.
And Vargas Llosa doesn't just lay it out chronologically, does he? The structure itself is quite ambitious.
Oh, definitely. That's key to its power. He braids together three distinct timelines, three perspectives that constantly echo each other.
So what are those threads?
Well, you have the conspirators, the men waiting to ambush Trujillo on that highway in 61. Then you're inside Trujillo's own head during his very last day. And crucially, there's the modern thread, Urania Cabral.
Right, Urania. She returns to Santo Domingo in 1996, decades later.
Exactly. That interplay between 61 and 96. That's the core of it.
Why do you think he chose that structure? Does constantly cutting back and forth, focusing so much on this kind of hyper-realism, risk losing some of that literary, maybe magic associated with the boom generation?
I think it actually deepens the impact. You know, it's not about losing magic. It's about showing how the past isn't past. By intercutting, Vargas Llosa creates this feeling that the trauma of the dictatorship is still alive.
Mm.
It's a living wound in 1996, shaping Urania's reality.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the reader feel that sense of inescapable history, almost like a collective memory trap.
That makes a lot of sense. And Urania Cabral really becomes the center of that, doesn't she? Almost the moral compass of the novel.
She really does. We meet her as this very successful, but emotionally quite isolated lawyer living in New York. She comes back after 35 years away.
A self-imposed exile.
Right. And she's not back for reconciliation. Not really. She's there to confront her father, Agustin Cabral. He was once a high-ranking official in Trujillo's regime, nicknamed Cerebrito. Little brain. Now he's old, silent, incapacitated by a stroke.
So her journey isn't about healing old family wounds necessarily. It feels bigger than that.
It absolutely is. It's like a civic act disguised as a personal one. Her long silence was how she survived. But now, returning and speaking, especially in that incredibly difficult monologue to her father, it's her way of forcing a confrontation.
Forcing a testimony.
Exactly. Testimony. She's trying to reclaim the narrative that fear had buried for so long. She embodies the nation's struggle to face its own past.
Okay, let's shift to the figure casting that long shadow, Trujillo himself, El Chivo. How does Vargas Llosa make this monster responsible for decades of brutality feel complex and terrifyingly human, not just a caricature?
Well, one key way is by focusing on his physical vulnerability on his last day, May 30th, 1961. Here's this man with absolute power, the benefactor, but internally, he's consumed by paranoia.
And obsessed with his image.
Right. Completely obsessed.
Yeah.
Maintaining this facade of virility, of being infallible, but his body is betraying him.
The novel is quite explicit about certain physical issues he's facing.
Yes. His struggles with incontinence and also impotence. And there's a profound irony there, isn't there? The man controlling an entire nation can't control his own bodily functions.
It's almost symbolic.
It absolutely is. That physical decay mirrors the moral and political decay of the regime he built. It's like the whole system is rotting from the inside out, starting right at the top.
So his constant need for sexual validation, these encounters, it's more than just personal appetite.
Oh, much more. It's a performance of power. Every conquest is about assertion, about humiliating others, proving his dominance still holds, even as his physical power wanes. And ultimately, that very hubris, that need, it leads to his downfall.
Speaking of downfall, let's talk about the plot to assassinate him. What makes the conspiracy feel so, so grounded and almost tragically inevitable? The motivations seem incredibly personal.
They are brutally personal, and that's what gives the plot its raw energy. It's not just abstract ideals. Take Antonio de la Maza. His primary drive is pure revenge. Trujillo had his brother killed. It's a blood feud.
Simple as that.
Pretty much. Then you have others, like Amadito Garcia Guerrero. He's younger, initially loyal.
What turns him?
Disillusionment. The regime targets his fiancée's family, and that personal blow shatters his loyalty. His journey is more about a moral awakening prompted by personal injustice.
So their wait on that highway, it must be incredibly tense.
You feel it. The waiting, the fear, the doubts, the personal grief simmering beneath the surface. It shows how revolutions often spark from individual wounds inflicted by tyranny, not just grand political theories.
And Trujillo, because of his own compulsions, walks right into it.
He does. That night, he drives out planning a rendezvous, obsessed with his predatory need. And crucially, he goes without his usual heavy security detail. His arrogance serves him up on a platter.
So the conspirators succeed. They actually kill him.
Yes, the ambush works. They kill Trujillo right there on the dark road. It's abrupt, violent. They achieve the physical act. But then comes the tragedy.
They expected something more.
They hoped his death would ignite a wider military uprising, a real revolution. But it doesn't happen. They fundamentally misjudged how deeply entrenched the system was, beyond just the man himself.
And the consequences are immediate and brutal.
Horrifyingly so. Instead of liberation, the assassination unleashes Trujillo's security apparatus, the SIM. They launch this vicious campaign of revenge.
Hunting down the conspirators.
Systematically. Torturing them, executing them. It's one of the novel's bleakest points. Killing the dictator was, in a way, the easy part. Dismantling the fear and the structures he built, much harder. The immediate aftermath benefits the functionaries, not the people.
Which brings us back, I suppose, inevitably, to Urania. Her private story holds the key to the regime's deepest corruption, revealed in that final devastating confession.
That's the absolute emotional core, the climax of the novel's pain. Urania finally tells her family the truth she's carried for 35 years. Her father, Agustin Cabral, had fallen out of favor with Trujillo.
And to get back in.
In a desperate act of self-preservation, seeking to regain his position, he offered his own 14-year-old daughter, Urania, to Trujillo as a sexual sacrifice.
It's almost unthinkable. The betrayal is just absolutely...
Not just the act itself, horrific as it is. It's the fact that it's her father.
Yeah.
The ultimate intimate betrayal, showing how the dictatorship poisons the most fundamental human bonds, twisting even parental love into a tool for political survival.
And Cabral believed he was acting in their best interests.
That's the chilling implication. He likely justified it as necessary for the family's survival within that brutal system, that immoral compromise, that degradation of the spirit within the home. That's tyranny's deepest wound.
So stepping back from the plot, the assassinations, the immediate drama, what are the big takeaways here? What enduring questions does Vargas Llosa leave us with, especially about societies recovering from such regimes?
I think the central theme has to be complicity in the nature of evil. The novel powerfully argues that these systems don't just rely on the monster at the top. They thrive on the fear, the ambition, the participation of ordinary people, like Agustin Cabral.
It forces a really uncomfortable look at collective guilt, doesn't it? If survival meant compromise for so many.
Exactly. There's that line, something like, in a dictatorship, everyone is guilty. Those who kill, those who are killed, and those who simply survive. The guilt spreads because the silence, the complicity was so widespread.
Which makes Urania's journey from silence in exile to testimony upon return so critical. It ties into memory and historical trauma.
Absolutely. Her exile was an attempt to escape memory, to wall it off. But her return is this painful, necessary confrontation. She embodied the idea that silence doesn't heal. It perpetuates the trauma.
It lets the past control the present.
Right. Like that quote suggests, memory is the only territory where the dead can defeat the living. Without confronting the truth, without testimony, the ghosts of the regime continue to haunt the nation, making genuine healing impossible.
And we should also touch on the literary craft here. It's not just history. The way he tells the story is incredible. The shifting perspectives, the free indirect discourse. It can feel quite immersive, almost dizzying.
Oh, it's masterful. That technique lets us slide right into the characters' minds. Trujillo's paranoia, the conspirators' fear, Urania's cold anger. By constantly shifting viewpoint, no single perspective gets the final say. It mirrors the fractured, contested memory of the nation itself.
And the symbolism is so sharp. Trujillo's incontinence, we mentioned that. What about locations like the Mahogany House?
The Mahogany House is terrifyingly symbolic. It's where Trujillo conducts state business and carries out his sexual assaults. It physically embodies the fusion of political power and predatory violence.
There's a constant dramatic irony too, isn't there? Especially with Trujillo on his last day.
Definitely. His obsession with his appearance, his medals, his belief in his own control, right up until the moment of his violent end on that dark highway. It's potent irony.
Which circles back to maybe the most cynical theme, the illusory nature of freedom. Trujillo dies, but the system, it adapts. The role of Joaquin Balaguer is crucial here.
Balaguer is fascinating. He's presented initially as this quiet, harmless poet, Trujillo's puppet president, a figurehead.
But he's more than that.
Much more. When Trujillo is gone and there's chaos, Balaguer emerges as this incredibly shrewd political operator. He outmaneuvers everyone Trujillo's family, the remaining conspirators.
So killing the man didn't dismantle the machine.
Not at all. Balaguer ensures the system's continuity, just with a different face. It shows the resilience of authoritarian structures, the bureaucracy, the ingrained fear, the habits of complicity. Those are harder to kill than one man. Balaguer's quiet triumph is perhaps the novel's most sobering conclusion.
So ultimately, the novel seems to argue that tyranny's deepest scar is that moral corrosion, the way it forces betrayal and makes silence a necessary shield.
I think so. And it really challenges us as readers to see that real liberation isn't just about one decisive act of violence. It's about the slow, painful work of truth-telling, of confronting that collective complicity.
Urania's final act is choosing testimony. Choosing to speak the unspeakable, to reclaim her own story, her own soul. Perhaps the lesson is that for societies to truly heal, they have to make that same choice, embracing the pain of truth over the false comfort of silence. Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.